Villages with abandoned children in Bolivia and Costa Rica, to what they call cram schools in Taiwan, to preschools and elementary schools in Denver, and he's currently a first grade teacher in Denver. So get ready as we welcome back for part two our fine guest, David Schindel. David, hello.
Hello, Ken.
So glad to have you back, and excited to carry on further with these gifts of how we can use the nonviolent communication to literally make our communication help our lives to work so much more easily and more lovingly.
Yeah, great. I'm just very thankful for being on this show to be able to share this this process of communication that's been so powerful in my life, and I'm really just excited to share some of the skills around how to do this in a practical way in your life.
Yes, there we go. And I know you had sent me some notes on some keys for compassionate communication, which is another term for the NVC. We've got the nonviolent way of talking about it. We've got the compassionate communication way. I guess they're both kind of interchangeable. Is
yes,
that right?
Yes, they are. Because that word, the compassion there, it's really about how to use language in a way that evokes compassion from other people, and that also opens our heart to compassion for other people who, no matter how they're expressing themselves, that we can find that place in ourselves. And, you know, when I was most of my life, you know, I've heard these, you know, things about be compassionate, be like Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King, you know, and I never really knew, like, what if I don't, you know, feel that? I just don't feel it in me. And nonviolent communication is a real way of seeing the world that actually can it gives you a structure that opens the doors of compassion. So I'm really excited about sharing some of these keys with you and your listeners.
Yes, absolutely. And we may have someone out there that has some kind of a burning desire to ask you some questions. Would you be okay if we open
that
the phone line?
That would be lovely. I would love to hear from anybody.
Okay.
Has some questions, yes.
Okay, so if you have something going on, and it can be with the work setting, with relationships at home, spouse, children, you name it, I invite you to call in our toll-free numbers for the U.S., 877-876-5227. If you're in the U.S. or Canada, 888-815-9756. And if you outside of those areas, call 530-876-3222. All right. Well, David, so as we're getting into this, what's kind of one of the initial points that you'd like to make picking up from last week? Do you want to cover any review or move ahead?
Yeah.
What's
And I like this idea of kind of going, you know, I was thinking a lot about this, and what are like the seven kind of key components of this process, and the first one I believe is the most important one, and that has to do with the consciousness, and this is what I talked a lot about last week, so I won't go into that much depth, but it's really about focusing on creating a quality of connection in which everyone's needs matter and can be met. And so this is a real paradigm shift from what we've been brought up with in our culture, which is how to win, how to get what we want, you know, how to win friends and influence people. That's the type of culture we have. And so this is a very different focus. And if we practice, so it's kind of focusing on connection before the outcome. And if we don't have this consciousness, it can become just a mechanical process that can be used as just another technique to manipulate other people into giving you what you want. And so just really quickly, I want to just go over that consciousness, what it is. It's basically there's three principles. One of them is that all of us have the same universal needs. If you go to Africa or China, it doesn't matter where you are, you can see people meeting just fundamental needs that we all have in common, like caring and trust and respect. All these are needs that we all have in common. And that everything we do is an attempt to meet a human need. And so no matter what it looks like on the outside, no matter how much we disagree with it, if we really get to the need level, we can connect. And I'm going to give you a quick example of this, just to give listeners an idea of the different this consciousness and what we've been brought up with. There was a boy in my class. Well, I got a phone call in my class. I work with children, teacher, and this child did not want to come to school because he was afraid of another boy who the day before had been, you know, had his hands around his throat choking him. Or not his hands. I think he had him in kind of a headlock kind of thing.
Oh,
so
okay.
Anyway, you know, what to do, how to deal with this situation in a way that brings connection instead of disconnection. And so when I sat down with this boy, the first thing in the morning, I want to establish a quality of connection with the child. And this is very different. What I was brought up to do would be like to come in and say, that is not okay that you did that. That is wrong. And, you know, I'm sorry, but you can't go to gym anymore. And the kid goes off and he's mad at me. He's mad at the other child. But this is kind of the way we've been taught, you know, it's kind of like a punishment. He deserves it because he shouldn't have done that. And the other way that I'm learning to do this is that first I want to establish a quality of connection with this child. So I make a guess. There's a curiosity there. I wonder, since I'm seeing him as a human being just like me, I wonder what need that we have in common he was trying to meet by doing that. And I'm not agreeing with what he did, but I just want to connect to the humanity in this child. So he said something about, well, he was being mean to my friend, and that's not okay. So you really were trying to protect your friend. Yeah, I was trying to protect her. He can't go and do that. You know, that's not right. So what I'm hearing is that you're really caring for your friendship. It's just really important for you to do that. So he says, yes. And so notice that, you know, at this moment right here, I have a connection. I have power with this child. I'm not judging him as a bad kid. I'm seeing the dignity and the need. Not that I totally disagree with the strategy, but I'm going to get to that.
Yeah, so underneath, there was an external behavior. He had gotten a classmate in some sort of a headlock or chokehold.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we don't want that going on.
Mm-hmm.
But when you interviewed and connected with him and determined that there was a positive intent under this action,
yeah,
and the positive intent for why he was doing that was to protect a friend of his.
Exactly, yes, that's what it was. And so when he felt heard, when he felt that I wasn't there to punish him, I was there to understand, I was there to connect with him, then I also am not going to give up my need for safety in my classroom and in the school. That's a very precious need for me. I know that children can't learn if they don't feel safe at school. So I'm not giving that up. I want to do this in a way, as I said, the very first key to this process is focus on creating quality connection, which everyone's needs matter and can be met. And so my needs matter too. And so once he feels really understood, I come with my needs. For, you know, I just talked to this parent and her child doesn't want to come to school, and I have a real need for safety of kids, you included. I really want you and your friend to be safe. So I'm wondering, you know, what could you do the next time that would, you know, that you could care for your friend and also be safe with the other children. And so it's not me telling him what he's going to do. It's not me putting a consequence on the child. It's two human beings working together to figure out how to get all of our needs met. And what this child figured out, you know, I was emailing this parent at the time when I was talking to him, and I showed him the letter, and he said, well, I could write to her and say that I won't ever do that again. And that's something that came from him. And that really, I think the parent, it really gave her the reassurance that she wanted to send her child to school. She wanted to know her child's going to be safe.
Mm.
So it just is a different way of going about it. You know, I could have forced this child to not do it by really punishing him. But, you know, he doesn't learn that way. It's a real passive thing, this whole punishment bit. You know, a kid gets punished and, okay, I've done my time and now I'm, you know, out and about again. When David's not looking, I'm going to do the same thing again because I haven't learned. I haven't learned about, you know, anything about humans, connection there. How does that make sense? Is that clear?
Yeah. Yeah, and in the punishment part, there's no looking at, was there some underlying positive intent in this behavior?
Yeah, yeah.
That's completely eliminated when we judge someone they're wrong, and we've got to stop this behavior, and in that theory, the way to stop it is by some form of punishment.
Yeah, exactly, Ken. I'm glad that you picked up on that, because this really does speak to kind of a worldview of what is our nature, you know. And if I see people that we're all just trying to meet our needs, and that really the most lovely thing that anybody would want to do is to contribute to life, I interact with this person in a different way than if I thought that, oh man, people are just trying to get away with what they can, and they're really selfish, mean, and fickle. And so if I believe that, then I'm going to need to control children and set up punishments and rewards for them. So, yeah.
Ah, and so as you're honoring that, it's very important to have some ground rules or some agreements that,
yes,
everyone wants to be safe.
Yeah, yeah. He could really see that. Yeah, definitely.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's an important point.
Yeah. And so let's see here. The other part after getting the second key that I would want people to know in learning this process is something that I would call going on a language cleanse.
A language cleanse.
We go on food
cleanses. That.
And so we go on food cleanses to have health. And I would suggest this language cleanse for the health of your spirit and your heart. And so the important thing about this language cleanse is it's about learning about the language of disconnection so that we know what words to avoid. And I want to say a word of caution about language. I'm not saying that this is the wrong way to talk and that MBC is the right way to talk, because that would be getting into this whole right-wrong way of thinking. What I really like to emphasize when I talk about these words that I recommend eliminating from your vocabulary is just how they get us to focus our attention outside of ourselves, where we don't have any power. And in my experience, MVC helps me connect to myself, and the language of disconnection, well, doesn't. And so I also, before I get into the language, I did a fun game with my daughter. It was called the 50-cent game. And I, you know, I put on a piece of paper all the words that if she heard me saying, I would pay out 50 cents. And I tell you, I had to stop the game because she was getting really rich and I was getting very poor. But it was a wonderful game for a while it lasted, because it really helped me, and it helped get the support I wanted for living this consciousness. So I call these, a simple way to remember these are the four D's of disconnection. And the first one is diagnoses or interpretations, judgments of other people and yourself. And so these are things like good and bad, right, wrong, appropriate, inappropriate, rude. And so when we're in the consciousness, we realize that there is no such thing as all of that. We see that these are, as I said the week before, these are tragic expressions of unmet needs when we use words like bad and wrong and inappropriate. And it...
And that's not really describing what's going on, is it?
It isn't, Ken. And that's why with anybody, and especially children, this type of language isn't helpful for them learning how to actually be compassionate and how to live with each other.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't give the information.
Yeah, and... this is maybe a bit amusing or may not even apply, but as we were talking about this, it's sort of like sometimes we can see something but not know all that's going on. We might, and this was an example, getting a picture in my mind that there is someone and they're laying on the ground, and a person is bent over, and it looks like they are actually biting their leg. You can't tell because you just see the back of the person's head, but you know they've got their mouth on their leg.
Uh-huh.
And you could think, wow, you know, and the person, you know, could look like they're in pain, and you'd be thinking, this idiot or whatever, this terrible person is biting this other person and causing them pain.
Yeah.
And what could have gone on is they could have been bit by a snake, and they were there actually sucking venom out, and the person was in, was experiencing pain from the snake bite.
Yeah, yes, I like that example, because for me it highlights the sense of openness and curiosity about not having judgments, and and so that we're very open to seeing what's going on for this person. I want to connect instead of judge,
mm-hmm.
and so. It's so very different from what we've learned in our culture, which is, successful people know everything, and they're able to do everything. And nonviolent communication, it's really about not knowing. It's about having a curiosity and openness. And Eckhart Tolle speaks about this in his book, The New Earth, when he says that when you think you really understand something, at that moment you've lost connection.
Ah,
and I just love that. He gives the example of a bird, of a small young child observing a bird, and when the child knows the name bird,
mm-hmm.
child knows what it is. Oh, that's a bird. Oh, that's another bird. Oh, that's another bird. It just you stop observing. And I think that's similar to what happens in our communication when we make an interpretation and we know what somebody is doing, then we lose that connection.
Yes.
Because also the other thing about this language is that it's a static language. The language that we've been taught in our culture is a static language. You are, he is, I am. It tricks us into believing that we are a certain way and that we're not in process. All of life is in process. After this call, we will never be the same. I will be different. I will be a different person. But our language tricks us into thinking that it's a static world, and that breaks connection. And so nonviolent communication is a process language that's, for me, it's a more accurate map of reality. And that helps me connect more.
Yes.
Yeah. So, anyway.
All right. So now, were there more D's that
yes,
you wanted to cover?
The diagnosis, which is the judgments. The second one is denial of responsibility. So thinking that we don't have choice. So these are words like can't, have to, must, should. These words they get us once again to look how they focus our attention outside. I can't do it. Why can't you? Because my dad said so. Well, what does that mean? there's no human connection. There's no connection to it. Why is it that my dad values this thing? There's not a human connection. It's just something that's out there, and there's no real understanding that connects us. And it also, the other thing with this denial of choice is that usually it puts us into this dichotomy, because it's either you have two choices with this language. Either you do it, and even though you don't want to, you just submit to it, or you don't do it and you rebel. And so that's the kind of choice when we're not connected to values. We can't really dialogue about what's going on for us. So
wow. Well, this is important.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then there's demand language, which gets into, which kind of goes with the good and bad thing, because we need to know who's good and bad so we know who to reward and punish. And this later I'm going to be giving the kind of anecdote to this, which is how to make a request. So we'll be talking about that later. But this really, once again, it kind of speaks to a certain worldview that we have, that people on their own wouldn't be good to each other. They wouldn't be compassionate to each other. They need to have rewards and some type of exterior motivation, because it's not inside of us to be that way. And the last one is deserve language, which is something that's just very, you go to any movie and you see the deserve language, and when the bad guy gets it, we all shout hooray. Because we've been educated, a domination culture requires that we are educated to enjoy violence. and deserve language does that. Oh, he deserved it, you know. And
I see
kids in my class smiling when another child is crying because they've been steeped in this.
Ah, okay. So this deserve it, the way, if I'm understanding, the way it's typically been set up is that there has been something that's gone wrong. And the theme has played out in thousands, I'm guessing, of movies with different themes, but this are different sets of circumstances. But someone has been, quote, wronged. Their dog has been taken away. Their bike has been stolen. Their father was murdered. I mean, the list goes on and on of different acts of some form of violence or something that has happened to someone. And thus, to set things right in the world again, someone deserves to be punished for this.
Yeah, yeah. And it's something that we almost take for granted. but if you, yeah. And so, and once again, there's no, it's not about, I wonder what was going on for him. You know, what need was he trying to meet by doing this? And, you know, and then we would use something that we would call the protective use of force. You know, if somebody's doing something that's actually, you know, hurting people in the community, we don't just try to understand the person. That's not enough, that we need to also protect. But it's done in a way that doesn't, that isn't punishing the other person.
So we
understand, and this moment there's not time to communicate with this person before he or she does more damage. So we're going to use a protective use of force. So we're going to, you know, stop this person physically.
This is different than the typical thing of the Bible, this eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth,
yeah,
kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. That says, okay, if someone hurt someone and they broke their arm, then you get that person and you who did that dastardly deed, and then you break their arm, or you know, take their eye out if they blinded the other person. And we're saying, well, wait just a moment here. The first thing we do is to prevent any further harm from taking place.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't inflict harm on the perpetrator.
That's right. And so It's a very different energy. You know, I could do the exact same action in my class with these two different types of consciousness. One is, you know, protective use of force, and the other one is punishing. You know, and so I could ask somebody to leave the circle and have that be said in a way that's kind of demeaning to the child. That I'm implying that something that they've done is wrong. And it's a very different energy if I say, you know, I really want to teach this lesson, and it's very difficult for me with what you're doing right now. Would you be willing to stop that or go to a different place? You know, it's a very different thing. And if the child doesn't respond, I might use protective use of force. You know,
mm-hmm.
So it's not done out of a sense of punishment. It's just that at this moment I am valuing more my time and what I can, you know, what I can do with all these children here. I'm valuing that so much that I just don't know how to do that and you know, get your needs met in this moment.
Sure. Now, so, something that it might be relevant at this time, and I'm not sure if you had mentioned this or going to, but Reverend Michael Beckwith, the senior minister at the Agape Church, who was one of the stars of The Secret and the Moses Code, a number of things, in some of his sermons, one of the things that he mentioned was that there's some states that have capital punishment and some that don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that they did the statistical survey, and what they discovered is that states in which there's capital punishment, where it's okay to take a life for someone having done some very nasty crime, that when there's that consciousness, all the states that have this capital punishment actually have higher rates of violent crime. than states where they don't have capital punishment.
Wow.
Yeah. So that is very much in support of, I believe, of what you're trying to illustrate.
Yes, yes. And I think in terms of my experience, I see how that would happen. In my class, if I'm seeing children in that way as oh, you guys are a bunch of rabble-rousers and you know, you guys are just always messing around, and if I see them that way, they're just more apt to act that way, because I'm really not seeing them, not understanding them. And so it's what happens here that I see is this vicious cycle. And this is what reinforces us to think that punishment works, is that, you know, we try to control kids or adults, and nobody likes being controlled, so they start to act out. And then we say, see, we really need to control them more. And so we put more controls on them, and then they start to react even worse, and it's like, oh, boy, see, we really need controls. But really what we haven't looked at, you know, is how we've structured that initial environment that creates those types of problems. You know, if we deny choice, you know, or if we make choice difficult for children and adults, they're going to start acting out, you know, because they're not being understood for things that are valuable for them, you know. And so that's, you know, it's a natural reaction. And and oftentimes I don't think, you know, teachers really see their part in that, and you know, in adults as well, in any relationship. So that's an interesting dynamic.
Oh, yes. And wanted to just to pause for a moment to also once again invite listeners to come on board and challenge you with something that they may have in a communication area, and give those numbers again. Toll free in the U.S., 877-876-5227, Canada, 815, Canada again, here it is, 888-815-9756, and for outside of those two areas, 530-876-3222, and of course, for those tuning in, you've just tuned in to Advanced Living Radio with David Shindall as our guest today, and this is being brought to you through the auspices of AdvancedLiving.com. And we invite you to go there, and we're talking about ways of dealing with nonviolent communication, more compassionate communication, and at AdvancedLiving.com invite you to take a look at an item called a comfort clock that changes the energetic ambience, relieves enough stress that we've gotten reports of people that were very grumpy and argumentative. They've become calm and very much easier to deal with, or some people that were acting out in violent ways. When these comfort clocks were put into their setting, it relieved enough stress that they could handle situations without having to act out violently. Now, we want to go beyond that with David today and learn more about this NVC, nonviolent communication, or compassionate communication. So let's carry on, David.
Okay.
Where's our next move from here?
Yes, so I'll go to the third key. So the first one was about focusing on connection over outcome. The second is the language cleanse, words that lead to disconnection. And the third one is, I'm going to get into the real kind of heart of the skills of NVC, which is how to make an observation, that would be one point, how to express feelings, how to express needs, and how to make a request.
Ah.
And so these are really, you know, I see this as really a spiritual discipline, these steps. I don't see them as just like a technique. I see them, you know, Marshall Rosenberg, the founder of the Center for Nonviolent Communication at www.cnbc.org, says that, you know, there's nothing really new about nonviolent communication. I think what's new is that it's organized in a different way, but these principles are really, if you look into religion, spirituality, you'll see these same principles over time. So the first one is about making an observation. And the universal principle here is about how to be with just what is and not make it something else, how to just observe something as it is. Krishnamurti once said that the observation without evaluation is the highest form of human intelligence. And so I've noticed that many problems can get solved right at this step.
And do you know something that comes to mind? And, of course, this is there's a little, for old episodes, this goes back a number of years, so some of our younger listeners may not relate to this, but if you go get any of the old issues of a TV show, Dragnet, when Sergeant Joe Friday would approach someone and he was going to question them, he would always say, "Just the facts, ma'am."
That's right.
Just the facts, sir.
Yep. I remember Joe Friday, yeah. Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts.
Yeah.
He wanted to cut to the chase, didn't he?
Yeah, we're not trying to get your opinion about this. We're just and does that relate at all to what we're talking about in making an observation?
You know, Joe Friday said that very well, just as well as Kristen Murdy in my mind. Just the facts. Because it really does lead to clarity and efficiency. You know, if you really want to get to the root of the problem, you want just the facts. And I've you know, cataloged all these things that happen in my house that lead to conflict. And, you know, from the very get-go, we get into conflict when we don't know the difference between an observation and an evaluation. And this can be very subtle. So, for example, if I say to my daughter, "God, oh, my gosh, this room's a mess," I get conflict right away. Because it's like, hey, I'm doing a project here. You know, I've been working really hard on this. I need all this space to organize it. So, look, we have conflict right away because we disagree about what is. And so the art of this is about how to say something that the other person can just readily agree upon so that it just opens the doors to communication, opens the doors to connection. So I say, "Wow, I see that there are papers all over the floor and I cannot see the floor from here to the door." And she would look at it and she would say, "Yep, that's right." And so right now it's we have agreement, we have a connection. It's kind of like setting the table. So an observation is what we experience directly with our senses. It's what we hear, smell, touch, see, and taste. And as you said, it just contains just the facts. So it also opens ourselves up to the other person's experiences. As I was talking before, it kind of gives us an openness or a curiosity about what's alive in the other person instead of assuming that we know. So, but when we mix this with an evaluation, what we're likely to get is disagreement, defensiveness, or people closing down. So,
And
it's a very subtle thing, you know, because I like to make an observation and be conscious that my perceptions could be wrong, you know? And so it's the difference between saying, "When you said," and "When I heard you say this," because I want to be open that maybe I didn't hear it correctly.
Ah.
And so there's just a real openness that openness is all about connection. My goal is connection. When I heard this, is this what was, you know, and then we go to the next step. So I'll just give you a couple of examples of this differentiation. So an observation mixed with an evaluation might be something like, "You're always late." And the observation would be, "When you arrive 30 minutes after the time we agreed upon." And that person would say, "Yep, that's true." And so versus, you know, "You're always late," it's like, "I'm not always late. Remember that one time 6 years ago I was right on time?" But that's not the point, right?
Yeah.
So even if you
said you're frequently late,
yeah, that's open to interpretation, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. And so I would just say, you know, in the last three times that we said we would get together, you've been at least 15 minutes late each time. You know, and so that's something that we could probably agree upon. So yeah, those words like often or never or always, I would put those on my language cleanse words in terms of making a clear observation.
Yeah, those sweeping generalizations.
Yeah. So the other thing that I've just recently begun to appreciate about observations is that word appreciation. And observing things in a new light and just seeing something as you've never seen it before. I think is, you know, it's like the book Zen Mind, Beginning Mind, which I, Beginner's Mind type thing, which I haven't read, but I get that concept. It's like seeing something as if it were the first time you're seeing it. And there's a certain appreciation and just a different energy that you bring to a situation when you see it that way. That this isn't the, you know, however many times it's happened, this one is different.
Wow.
So.
Wow. Okay. And that another little frame of reference for that, if anyone's seen that wonderful movie, Zorba the Greek, there was a scene in there where he was talking about making love with a woman, and he proclaimed, every time I make love with a woman, it is like the first time I am making love with her.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, boy. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yep.
Thank
you for the example.
Oh, you're welcome.
So the next step is stating a feeling that was stimulated by the observation. And I say stimulated versus cause, and this is a big differentiation. In our culture, we think that our feelings are caused by another person. You did this, so I feel this. And that is a real key point, Ken, that if people could just get that part, that would be revolutionary in your life. My feelings comes, I link them to my needs. I feel because I need. I don't feel because you did something. Because if I do that other one, I just give all my power away to you, or to the other person. And so my feelings are stimulated by observations. And one of the things about feelings is that they're neither positive or negative in nonviolent communication. They're just messengers that bring us information about whether or not our needs are being met in the present moment. So they can also give us information about where we are focusing our attention. And I really love what Marshall says about this. He talks about the four friends. And the four friends are anger, shame, depression, and guilt.
Ah.
Do those seem like four friends to you?
Not on the surface, but given the theme that we're taking of taking everything as new, I'm going to be curious about how those could be friends.
Yes, and they're four friends because they're like alarm clocks. They're like these messengers. When I feel one of those four feelings, anger, shame, depression, and guilt, it's like, oh, you know, red flag, I am thinking in a way that is disconnected from life. If I'm angry, there's usually, I would say, I can't imagine a time when there's not. If I'm angry, there's a thought under there that somebody is doing something that they shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, and my power, my responsibility in this process of communication is about, I choose where I focus my attention. If I focus my attention on what somebody should be doing or shouldn't be doing, then I'm putting my attention on those four D's of disconnection. And, you know, I'm going to have this whole flow chart of feelings from that. I can choose to focus my attention on needs there. So this tells me that I'm thinking in a way that's going to be disconnecting for me.
And to talk about something, I mean, one of the key things, if I'm thinking correctly about this, I want to make sure I'm getting this correct, you said that I'm feeling blank, whatever it is, I'm having some sort of feeling, so I'm feeling this because of I'm needing blank, something.
Yes.
If we did nothing more, talk about an idea for getting I wouldn't recommend this as a tattoo, but
yeah,
certainly, you know, you could consider, you know, writing it occasionally on the palm of your hand just to remind yourself.
Mm. Yeah, it really is. It's a really liberating thing, and it's hard. I was just writing about this on my blog that it's hard for our ego to. It's like a bitter pill for our ego to take that because it's putting complete responsibility on ourselves. But it feels right in my heart when I do that.
Yeah. Now, because we may not get to this today, I'm wondering, on your website, do you know if you'll be posting some list of needs so that people that may not have that information can get that? Or,
sure.
Or can they email? I'm not sure how, so I want to make sure people have a good way to contact you.
Yes, and and if you go to the www.compassionate-living.com, I will put up a needs list and a feelings list. So, and that's a wonderful literacy to start to develop, because it's really hard if you just hear do a language cleanse and don't say these words if you don't have something to replace it with.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, I highly recommend, you know, when you have a conflict, going through those feelings and needs lists and seeing what's, you know, just to start to develop that literacy. Yeah.
Oh, great.
So I can have that up, yes.
Okay. So go there, folks. And then, now, also, is there going to be information on how to reach you? Because, as I mentioned before, you do also some mediation or some consulting work.
Yes, and my contact information is on that website, but I'll just say it on the radio as well. My email is D, as in David, Shindoll, Shindoll, @hotmail.com, or you can always call me at 303-399-5170.
Okay, good.
So so I want to get to these last two steps before our time's out.
Yeah.
So the next step after you say the observation and the feeling, you know, I'm observing that there's a ton of papers, so many papers on the floor that I can't see the floor from here to the door. I'm feeling kind of, kind of irritated by this. And then there's a need. I want to connect my feeling to my need. I feel because I need. And from a lot of books that I've read on, you know, kind of connection, they kind of get to the feeling, but they don't really get to the meat of it, which is the need. The need of it is where we really connect. So so the key differentiation here is between a need and a strategy that we, and this is another huge one that we get confused on in our language. So the mixing a strategy with a need is, I need a hug. And so notice how this might make my abundant world very scarce. If I say, I need a hug from you. And the need there is around probably connection or just wanting some understanding or to be relaxed or something like that. Or another one mixed with strategy would be something like, I need you to stay home, versus I need some support and would like you to stay home to help me organize the office, for example. So you're kind of keeping those two separate. But what people do, in my experience, is that they confuse those and they get into trouble. I can give you a personal example about this.
Yes, please.
Did I talk about my wife and last time with the, I'm not sure if I did, about how we had been trying to have a child. My 12-year-old is my stepchild.
Okay, so please go ahead with the story.
Yeah, and so this is something I've wanted for all my life, with all my heart, is to have a child. It's something that I've really cherished, and my wife had two miscarriages, and then at that point, you know, it was really traumatic for my wife, and at that point she was just, I can't do this, you know, it's too much for me. I just really can't do that. So in this situation, it looks like we have conflicting needs, and this is another point about needs, is that their needs are never in conflict. Strategies are in conflict, but needs are never in conflict. And so in this situation, it's like one of us has to give up something. It seems like, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking at strategies, it looks like one of us has to give up. And boy, if I do this, then you're going to owe me, or something like this. And I could really see how something like this could really destroy a relationship. If you get focused on, you know, on the strategy. And luckily for me, I had been studying nonviolent communication for quite a while, and I was able to separate the need from the strategy. And so I asked myself, having a biological child is a strategy. And what's my need underneath? What are the needs that I think I would fulfill by having a child? And what I came up with was just awe and intimacy and just that deep connection with another person and the joy of seeing growth. You know, these are the needs that came up for me around a baby. And then I say to myself, you know, I know it wouldn't be the same, but could I get those needs met in a different way? And the answer is yes. Of course I can. And I see her needs also for, you know, wanting her body to be respected and wanting care for her body and her state of mind and some understanding about how painful this is for her. And so all these needs, that is intimacy right there. That understanding is intimacy. And even though it's a painful thing, I think this is another really valuable thing that I learned with nonviolent communication around feelings, around them. Our relationship to feelings and needs is very important. If I see them as positive or negative, I might try to run away from some feelings because I see them as negative. But now I really see that those feelings help connect me to a need. My feelings are telling me something. If I have a certain class of feelings, they tell me that a need is being met, and other class of feelings tell me that they're not being met. And so I just feel really grateful for the process that I was able to see how to get this met in a different way. And the way I'm doing it is by sharing MVC and really living MVC to get that intimacy and connection. So that's my example.
Yeah. Yes. Wow. Thank you.
So, and the last part of this, once we get connected to our needs, is to make a request. And this is probably the number one reason why people don't get what they want in their relationships, is because they don't know how to make a request. And so oftentimes, my wife and I sometimes laugh at this, about how she describes, you know, lots of people she knows as in relationships, that the wife will say something like, boy, this kitchen's really getting messy. And what she's saying is, you know, she's not making a specific request. I would like you to help me clean the kitchen. But in her mind, she's kind of saying, well, I said that, and I would assume that you would want to help me, you know. And making that specific request is really important to getting what we want. So let me give you an example of like a request that probably wouldn't work out for you, which is a real vague request, saying something like, I want you to listen to me. And isn't that just a classic one?
Mm-hmm.
And the husband say, I am listening to you. No, you're not. Yes, I am. I'm listening to you. So because it's so, what does listening mean? What does listening look like? So it needs to be very specific and concrete, the request that we make. Would you be willing to sit with me at the couch for about 10 minutes? And what I would like from you is, after I say this, I really want to hear how you feel about what I said. Or I really would like you just to say back to me what you're hearing me say. And that would get my need for being heard met. And so it's about being very specific about what we would like. And the difference here, and here I'll give you a little pop quiz here, Ken, what the difference between a request and a demand. If I say to you, Ken, would you please come over to my house for 10 minutes and help me out with this website from 5 o'clock, somewhere around 5 o'clock, would you be willing to do that, please? Is that a request or a demand?
Sounds like a request to me.
Yeah. Now, it was a trick question, Ken.
Ah.
It sounds like a request to anybody, right? Because I'm saying, please, and are you willing? But here's the thing about requests. You'll know if it was a request, if I can be just as happy with a no as with a yes. Because a request, my goal, once again, the first step is I just want connection. And a request is just moving me towards connection. So if I give you the cold shoulder, and say, oh, okay, oh, no, that's okay, Ken, yeah, that's okay, you know, geez, jerk, you know. That's what I'm thinking in my mind.
Well, that's just a beautiful place to wrap up our show for today, because we now have an important distinction and some other content. I just want to, David, thank you for sharing this with us, and let people know to go visit your website, compassionate-living.com, to learn more about this wonderful NVC. And, I mean, you're a wealth of knowledge, and I just want to thank you for taking time to be on the program.
Well, you're very welcome, Ken, and thanks again for the opportunity.
Oh, well, bless you and all my listeners. I invite you to learn more about David Shindall's work of nonviolent communication, and tune in next week when we're going to have a surprise guest. Troy Bayer is going to be on, a Hollywood star in many movies, who's written a book called X-Free, of how to recover from some pretty intense losses in the romantic part of our lives. Until then, thank you, David. Thank you, beloved listeners. I wish you all a wonderful week. Until we meet again, God bless you, and goodbye for now.
Let go and let God, let myself do.
Mm-hmm.